And I think we mostly have the same people here who are here at the first session, so I won't give a lot of intro overview. This is the second session. This is going to be me talking about the Open Philanthropy Project. And again, just want to emphasize that I'm happy to hear any questions, no matter where you're coming from or starting from, because we definitely don't expect people to read all the stuff we put out. And we offer these events largely as an alternative to reading so much stuff, and certainly not as a, you know, not as a as the next class or whatever. So I'm going to talk about the Open Philanthropy Project. My basic plan: first, I'm going to just give the overall view of what the Open Philanthropy Project is, how we're doing things, and then I'm going to talk about our work on U.S. policy, and that's going to be the longest part of this session. And then I'm going to take questions for a little bit. And then I'm going to talk about our work on global catastrophic risks and take some questions. And then I'm going to talk about our work on science and other causes and take some questions. So basically, GiveWell started in 2007. At that time, we were trying to serve people who were in the situation of saying, you know, I have some money to give. I don't have a lot of time to think about it. I want it to go to something I can understand. And that's how we came to the idea of promoting sort of proven cost-effective charities. In 2011, things changed when we got a lot of interest from Good Ventures, which is a new foundation funded by Dustin Moskovitz, the co-founder of Facebook, and the president is his wife, Carrie Tuna. And they were basically just getting started in philanthropy and saying, you know, we're going to be giving away a lot of money over the course of our lives. We're going to be at some point probably one of the major foundations in the U.S., and we want to do it as well as we can. And we're young for people who are thinking about philanthropy. We want to do it as well as we can. We met them and felt like we were really interested in a lot of the same questions, and decided to work closely together and jointly kind of launched this project that at the time was called GiveWell Labs, now is called Open Philanthropy Project. And the idea is to ask the question, if I'm a major philanthropist and I can, you know, hire my own staff and make major grants and create organizations and take big risks and make long-term bets and basically do whatever, how do I do as much good as possible with my giving? So it's largely continuous with the mission of GiveWell. It's asking, how do I give as well as possible? And then it's trying to be very transparent and open with the world about how we're thinking so that people can learn from it and so that we can influence the way others give. The difference is that the criteria are much more open-ended and the target audience is a little bit different. So we're mostly designing this as being targeted toward major donors, like people who, you know, could be giving away $100 million or $1 billion over the course of their lives. We are, I think, in the process also finding opportunities for individual donors to contribute to, but that's not like the thing that drives the project. So that's Open Philanthropy Project. We've been basically, this project is much newer and more experimental than GiveWell. It's important to recognize that. When GiveWell started in 2007, it was me and Ellie, it was two people, and we were, you know, experimenting a lot, and it took us a long time to get to where we had good top charities. That's kind of where Open Philanthropy Project is now. It's been 2 years of pretty intensive work, but it's been a small part of our staff working on it. It was, you know, basically me and Alexander Berger for a while, and we've recently added a couple of more people, plus Carrie, the president of Good Ventures. And so it's an early project. We don't have big giving recommendations yet, and because of the size of the question and the ambition of it and the open-endedness of it and how much capacity we're going to have to build, it could be years before we're saying, you know, give here. We see this as a really long-term project to build a lot of capacity, to move a lot of money to really big, long-term, and potentially risky stuff, and that makes it a very different project from GiveWell. Basic intellectual framework we're using is also different from GiveWell. So GiveWell Top Charities looks at the level of the organization or the intervention. We talk about bed nets, we talk about iodine, we talk about, you know, the Against Malaria Foundation. The main thing that we've talked about for Open Philanthropy Projects so far instead is what causes to focus on. And by a cause, I mean basically a problem in the world that a philanthropist might be able to do something about. And we've written about why we've kind of come to this lens and why we think this is the right framework. But basically, it's hard to evaluate an organization or a project without a lot of background knowledge about what they're trying to do and who else is trying to do it and how all the pieces fit together and what most needs to be done, especially when you really can't, you can't rely on randomized controlled trials the way we do with GiveWell Top Charities. A lot of the information about how to give well is going to be based on knowledge about people and about organizations and about political dynamics and about scientific issues. And so when you need so much background knowledge to assess one project, and then that background knowledge helps you assess a whole bunch of related projects, it seems like the most efficient question to ask is, what background knowledge do we want to develop? What do we want to be really intense about? What do we want to be knowledgeable about? What do we want to be experts in? Another reason to think this way is that a lot of what major philanthropists can do is, instead of just finding existing charities, they can create new opportunities. They can, you know, a lot of times what we found is if you go around saying, I want to fund X, new opportunities will come to you that you could have never found by just kind of asking people what to fund in an open-ended way. And we've got some interesting examples of that. So that's what we're trying to do right now. We've kind of divided the universe of different things you could do into four very broad categories. And then within those, we divide it further. So we're, you know, one of the broad categories of philanthropy that we look at is policy advocacy in the U.S. And what I mean by that is basically trying to influence, it's actually, a lot of it is not advocacy, but it's trying to influence the direction that policy takes in the U.S. by putting out information, by helping people understand the impact of different policies, by supporting groups that may put pressure on people to pay attention to certain interests. This is, you know, a lot of the major foundations today will tell you this is how to get the most bang for your buck, because by spending a small amount of money on, you know, people who try to put an issue on the map and try to raise the profile of an issue, you could change a law. You could help get a law changed or help increase the probability that a law changes. And government's power and money is like so much greater than what any kind of foundation has that that becomes a very leveraged impact. Another general area we're interested in is scientific research. So, you know, one of the things we've done is look for all the examples we can find of really amazing, successful philanthropic case, philanthropic success stories. And, you know, there's not a lot of work been done on that, but what we've seen, a lot of it is, again, you can get a big return when you spend a little bit of money funding some sort of investigation or research that then leads to a new insight that the whole rest of the world can use forever for free. So that's another way to get leverage. A third thing that we think about for having maximal impact is global catastrophic risks. These include things like climate change. They also include lower profile issues like pandemics or, you know, solar storms that may wipe out the electrical grid. Basically, anything that kind of threatens the whole world at once with a very low probability, it's not really clear whose problem these things are. And it seems like a good fit for philanthropy because you can have a very small impact of preventing something really, really large and catastrophic that sort of could derail or alter the course of civilization. And I think in the case of, you know, in the case of something like climate change, that's not hyperbole. And even in the case of some of these lower profile risks, I think it's not hyperbole either. So that's a chance for big impact, is to, you know, raise the profile and raise our preparedness for an understanding of global catastrophic risks. And finally, we remain interested in global health and development as a focus area because of the thing I said before about, you know, your money going furthest in the poorest parts of the world. And we don't just want to do that in the normal top charities way. We want to think broadly about what are all the things a philanthropist could do to help the developing world. So with those out of the way, the basic way our agenda looks is, this year we've been very focused on the first two categories I said, policy and global catastrophic risks. And we've had a goal of deciding what our focus areas are going to be, like what we're going to build knowledge about, what we're going to build staff for by the end of this calendar year, which is obviously like just about upon us. And I think we're going to hit something like that goal, because I think we largely have done the research we need to do and largely do know what we need to know to think about that decision. And then the other two categories are more for the future. So it's like once we pick causes in these areas and we have the capacity, we're then going to be putting more effort into exploring scientific research and global health and development and picking focus areas in there. So that's the overall framework. Next thing I'm going to talk about, and then I'll take questions, is I'm just going to get into a little more detail on our work on U.S. policy. And I think that'll be helpful in just thinking about how this whole thing works, because I think obviously everything I've said so far is a lot vaguer and more abstract than the GiveWell Top Charity stuff. So when we look at U.S. policy, the people working on that right now, first off, there's Alexander Berger, who's been with us for a while. He's a senior research analyst. And then Shayna Strom, who's a more recent hire, is actually in D.C. and is someone with much more of a political background. And this is an example of, you know, deciding on the things you want to be really good at. And part of how you handle that is you hire people who can be really good at those things. With policy, we've kind of tried to canvas the universe of U.S. policy areas. And we've asked three questions about most of the areas. We've asked, number one, how important is this policy? So, you know, there's people would like healthcare policy to be better. People would like gun control policy to be better. How important is each of these? How many people would we help by changing policy the way we'd like to change it? Question two is, how politically feasible is it to actually make a difference here? And so I think there are some issues that are extremely partisan and divided, and, you know, it's been a decade of people fighting each other and nothing seems to be happening. And there's other issues where there may be some sort of window of opportunity. I think it's easy to overrate this criterion, and most of the actual experts we've spoken to on policy have said, don't get too excited about what looks politically doable, because what's politically doable changes drastically and unpredictably on the relevant timeframes. And so a lot of times the worst thing you can do is chase headlines, get into some area because it's in the news, fund a bunch of groups, and by the time your funding is making any difference, it's, you know, the whole situation has changed. So that's something we've taken into consideration. Finally, classic GiveWell question, how crowded is the area? So if we're looking at climate change policy, well, there's a lot of people working on climate change policy and a lot of money going into trying to improve our policy to reduce carbon emissions. There may be other causes that are comparably important and don't get as much attention. And what we're really looking for is a policy area that is like not getting enough attention for how big a deal it is. That's the summary of what we're going for. So now I'm going to list some causes that we think are particularly outstanding by one or more of these criteria. And usually the way this works, I mean, we don't have any precision here. It's not like we can say, you know, this cause is a 2.2 on tractability and a 3.3 on importance, so we're going to multiply them together. More what we do is we kind of look for the most important causes and ask which of those do best on the other criteria. And we look for the most, you know, the most ignored causes and ask which of those do best on the other criteria, et cetera. So one cause we're interested in, as an example, is criminal justice reform. This is the one we've done the most work on. We're currently working on a deep dive of really trying to get to know everyone in the space, all the issues, think about all the things we could do, and potentially even hire a specialist. Criminal justice reform, so, you know, the U.S. has incredibly high levels of incarceration. Incarceration is really, you know, inhumane and really messes with people's life prospects. And there are good reasons to work on that. It's not, you know, it's not the biggest issue in the world, in our opinion. There are policy issues that matter more. What makes this, and it's not a neglected issue. There are funders working on it. What makes this area appealing to us is that it is one of the few areas, and kind of the only area, though there's a couple other candidates, that we've seen people point to again and again and say, there's opportunity here. There is political opportunity here because, and long-term political opportunity, not just a one-day news headline, because there's a structural situation where crime is lower than it's been for a very long time, incarceration is very high, and state budgets are really tight. And so where 10 years ago, everyone, or definitely 20 years ago, everyone was competing to be tough on crime, and there was, you know, the only people talking about less incarceration were on the left, now you have people on the right and the left actually collaborating. And, you know, some unusual people are kind of joining the cause. So, you know, there's Right on Crime, which often if you go there, you'll see like Grover Norquist on the front page. And they're saying, we need to stop locking so many people up. You can argue about why they're saying that. One reason, I think, is that it is a lot of government and it's a lot of money. At the same time, it's also really inhumane. So there's a political opportunity here, and that makes it an interesting cause. It's also a really, something we kind of realized about it later. It's what we call a high venue space, which means there's a lot of different places you could go to try to make change. So, you know, if you're working on, there's a lot of policies where the only thing you can do is hang out in D.C., and hope to influence federal policy. Criminal justice reform is mostly a state and local issue. You can influence judges, prosecutors, states, municipalities. There's a lot of opportunities to be opportunistic and find opportunities to make a difference. So it's a big space. It's a complicated space. There's a lot of funders in it, but we're trying to explore it very thoroughly, and we have a whole bunch of ideas about where the biggest juice might be. Another cause, which is very different, that we're interested in is labor mobility. So the argument here is that the best anti-poverty intervention that we are aware of is people moving from a poor country to a rich country. Actually, stepping across that border can cause someone's income to go up by a multiple. And it's just stepping across the border. It's the same person in a completely different economy with a completely different price on their skills. Obviously, this is a very politically heated issue. This is kind of the opposite of criminal justice reform. It doesn't look like it's going anywhere anytime soon. What we think is interesting about this cause is that even a small win in political terms could be really, really huge in humanitarian terms. If you're looking at how much you're causing more money to go to people who are coming from, you know, extremely low incomes. And so even small wins can be very big. And also, most of the philanthropic attention in this space is focused on the people who are already here, their path to citizenship, and not on this fact that, you know, crossing the border in many ways is the most important part of this whole story. So that's an area we're interested in. Center for Global Development is a big proponent of this idea, and we've supported some of their work on it. And by we, I mean GiveWell and Good Ventures working together as part of the Open Philanthropy Partnership. And we've also supported a couple of other groups that we found are, you know, really there was no other support for them because they're so focused on this, you know, labor mobility issue as opposed to immigrants' rights issue. Then there's macroeconomic stabilization policy, which we're trying to keep up with GiveWell Top Charities and having unsexy, complicated names for the things we do. Macroeconomics. So basic story here is there is a lot of debate over what happens when there's a recession and why recessions happen, and what the government can do to make recessions less severe. This is another area where I think there's a lot of reasons to believe this is a tough space to work in. It's also incredibly important. If you could make, you know, slightly decrease the depth of a recession in terms of how that compares to other causes where you might get a win, the win would be really huge. And also, there are a ton of economists and intellectuals who work on macroeconomics, but in other ways, the field is very underappreciated and kind of neglected. There's very little in the way of groups doing kind of public advocacy on this issue, trying to be political about it, even trying to come up with clever new ways to design policies that would be both good for the economy, but also like actually passable. And we think there is some fertile ground for that to try and think about these things, because it's not really a strict left and right issue. So that's another area we're looking into. We've made a few grants on it. I mean, we could do a whole meeting on any one of those grants, so I think we're going to have to be selective here with what we talk about, but that's one we think is interesting. Just to, you know, rapid fire through some other issues we've thought about a little less, policy around land use, zoning, how land is used, not the most important issue in the world, but there's like practically no one working on it that we can find. And so that's like an interesting question, is what happens when you see an issue that no one is working on? Can you get people to work on it? Can you raise its profile? Can you get some state and local wins that, you know, for the amount you spend might be actually a really huge return on your money? Foreign aid policy we're interested in. I actually think there's a pretty strong infrastructure already around advocating for more and better foreign aid, but we're interested in finding more stuff we could do on that. Factory farming, very popular topic with our audience, very controversial. I think, you know, animals are treated really, really badly on factory farms. I think most people don't know this, or don't know the extent of it. And so the question of whether that could change, also like a little bit less partisan than a lot of issues, arguably very important depending on how exactly you value animals, and not particularly crowded. There's a ton of animal charity, but it doesn't focus on this issue. It focuses more on strays and things like that, endangered species. What are we actually going to do? What are we going to focus on? I mean, there's this whole other question that we've been grappling with, which is how many causes should we work on? How should we work on them? How many people should we have on our team? What should those people do? And there's all these debates that I find very interesting, but they get very little attention about just how to structure philanthropy. So I think, you know, the most traditional way that a big foundation operates is they'll pick a number of issues. So they'll say criminal justice and labor mobility, and they'll hire like more than one or one person per issue, and that person will spend all their time just thinking about that issue. And they'll get to know everyone in the issue. They'll often be a pre-existing expert on it, like a criminal justice expert, and that's what they'll do, and then they have their program areas. But I've also seen some other groups that take a very different approach. They might be interested in 20 things at once, and they aren't experts on any of them, but they know a little bit about all of them, and they're looking for an outstanding opportunity. They're looking for something that really pops, or an organization that's really got great leadership and needs money, and that's a hard combination to find, so they grab it where they see it. And, you know, which of those models is more promising and is going to make more of the money? I think we have yet to learn what's going to work best for us and our skills, and also just works best in general. Where we're leaning right now is, you know, trying both of the things I just said. So I think we want to take at least one cause, and it's pretty likely to be criminal justice reform, where we take the, you know, try to find an expert or a real, you know, a real specialist approach. And then we may have, you know, more of a GiveWell generalist, someone like Alexander, work on a bunch of other causes at once and look for the best opportunities he could possibly find. Other challenges here, I mean, hiring is always difficult, and now we're talking about how to build a team, not just how to pick an organization. So a lot of what actually happens in the next few years, it's going to be driven by, you know, we're going to be trying to find the best people and the best organizations in a lot of causes, and a lot of what we actually do is going to be driven by whom we meet and how promising they are and what we end up jumping on. So that's where we stand on politics at the moment. I'll pause there and take questions before covering some other topics. Yep. I'm back. Yep.
I'm interested that you put macroeconomic stabilization on that list for the reason that that's a policy area that where a so-called expert opinion is ideologically polarized. You had a lot of center-right philanthropy, the Peter G. Peterson Foundation being Exhibit A, pouring money into macroeconomic stabilization defined as debt is killing us. You have to have a lot of young people agitated about the fact that, you know, life's going to be worse for their generation because of the national debt. Then you've got people like Krugman and Stiglitz saying 180 degrees opposite, that in a prolonged period of stagnation, you need a ton of public investment to create jobs, make the economy more productive, make up for the shortfall in private demand. So what does a group like yours that is looking for best practice do when it comes across a very important public policy area where expert opinion is completely polarized ideologically in terms of the diagnosis and the remedy?
Sure. So the question is, what do we do when we come across an issue where expert opinion is totally polarized? And then the example, you know, pointing out with macroeconomic stabilization, which is true, that there are, you know, there are some people putting a lot of money and effort into getting our debt down, and other people, prominent intellectuals, making arguments that we need to be doing deficit spending to help the economy. What do we do about that? It's two pretty different questions. I'll answer them one at a time. One, what do we do when expert opinion is polarized? You know, we have to weigh things like what do we think is the right side of an issue, but also how confident are we? A lot of these issues, I feel like the people who are both relatively, you know, informed and analytical, but also humanitarian in their alignment and motivations, they're often all coming down on one side of the same issue. Or there's, you know, there's not a lot of, like, the arguments don't seem balanced to us on a lot of the issues that we're most interested in. And that is a judgment call. And again, you know, Open Philanthropy Project, it's going to be a lot more controversial than GiveWell. That's part of why we're changing the name. And it's going to involve a lot of judgment calls, but I think that's how we're going to do the most good. But I do think with a lot of these issues, you know, it's like one side has the public interest on its side, or the humanitarian interest, which often is different from the American interest, or not exactly, you know, not exactly identical. And then the other side might have, you know, more like trade groups and groups that represent a certain set of more more personal interests or company interests. So, you know, we often see that things aren't polarized. if we feel that they are and we can't tell which side is stronger in its arguments or we're not very confident, that makes us less excited about an issue. That's been a major issue for us on macroeconomics in general. I do not feel as confident about which side we've picked for some of the grants as I do for a lot of other issues. On the other hand, I do feel convinced enough. I mean, I think, again, we could run a whole meeting just on that, given the size of some of the opportunities. And this is where I'm going to say that actually there are, you know, it's not as simple as the debate between Peterson wanting to cut the debt and Krugman wanting to do deficit spending. There's a lot of other ground in there that I think is pretty neglected and where there is room to do something differently. So two examples that I think are pretty important. One is, you know, neither of those two sides of the argument, although Krugman has opinions on this, are really talking about what the Fed should do. The Fed is different from, you know, the question of is our government doing deficit spending, how much is our government spending, is a totally different question from where's the Fed putting the interest rate, and more importantly, what happens when the interest rate hits zero and the Fed has to resort to unconventional measures. That question, I think, has less of a partisan valence, although it has some, and that's a question on which there's not a lot of advocacy going on. And most of the advocacy that is going on is more on the kind of we need to go back to a gold standard, we don't trust the Fed at all side of things. The idea of someone saying, you know, before you decide where to put that interest rate, you should hear from a working mom who cares a lot more about avoiding, you know, unemployment than about some of the other factors being considered, that is, I think, a powerful idea. It's something that isn't being tried. It's something that a group we're supporting is going to try to a small degree, and we're going to see how it goes. And I think there's a lot of potential power there. I also think there's, you know, obviously a lot of concerns. And your general Open Philanthropy Project grant is going to have much bigger upside and much bigger downside than your general GiveWell Top Charity. Another area that I think is a little bit to the side of the Krugman debate, the Krugman-Peterson debate, something we've thought about is, you know, okay, so when in theory, I think most people agree that the government should be spending more when the economy's weak and less when the economy's strong. But at any given time, the debate is always just breaking down between people who want more government and less government. Could you do a better job designing policies that over the long run are neutral with respect to the size of government, but are doing a better job making government counter-cyclical, making government spend when the economy's weak and save when the economy's strong? That, again, if you can design those policies, you may get through a lot of the partisan valence, and you may get rid of a lot of the debates that clutter things up now where everyone's talking about what to do today and it just ends up with the left wanting more and the right wanting less. Yeah, Eddie.
It seemed like a bunch of the topics you were going after were politically contentious arguments, topics where people have very different views.
Yeah.
It seems like there are other things where everyone agrees that they're good. Maybe it's like scientific research that's publicly funded or getting a better system, like computer system for Medicaid. And it's really the issue of getting the proper resources to them. And so you can say everyone agrees this is good, but the government, for whatever reason, doesn't want to fund it. And if your core thing is like moving money, you can say, hey, we're going to be the ones to provide that additional funding to these areas of the government that everyone agrees should be happening, but just can't get the funding they need.
Sure. So the question is, have we thought about sort of, instead of going into very politically contentious issues, going into issues where everyone agrees the government should be doing something better, but they don't have the funding and we could provide the funding. This hasn't been as much of a focus of ours. I think the leverage is just not as great. I mean, I think the kind of the whole point of working in policy is that you can, and there are very impressive cases, I believe, where you can spend a relatively small amount of money and you can put a group in position to raise the profile of an issue that people had been ignoring, and then you can have a massive impact. And I think, you know, paying ourselves for a new computer system for Medicare has, A, it has some problems because the government has so much more funding than we do that it's like if you start doing that, you could really wind up just spending all your money on the things the government doesn't want to pay for, and B, there just isn't the same leverage. So that hasn't been our focus. If we ran into something that we thought was like, you know, a really crazy opportunity, the government really ought to be doing something, we should just pay for it ourselves, I think we would. That hasn't been the main focus. Yep.
Yeah. Cheap and have tons of leverage.
Yeah.
Maybe you one or two.
Sure.
Summarize in a sentence or two.
Sure.
And second question is, I think I know why you guys are focusing on the U.S.
Yeah.
I think I've actually asked you this question before.
Okay.
But do you think that in the long run, or kind of like if you were based in, say, Germany, or I have in mind India and China, there probably is more leverage available for advocacy in countries like that, which are bigger and are kind of critical?
Sure. Two questions. One of them is, can I give examples of successful policy advocacy? And two is, do I think in the long run that we might have more impact working in other countries besides the U.S.? I'll take them one at a time. One, examples of advocacy being successful. First off, I should just note that we've gone through and tried to find all the claims we can that philanthropy supposedly made a big difference, and we keep a big list of those, and then we take the ones we're most excited about, and we actually have a couple people who we're contracting with, and they're historians, and they go and try to figure out what happened, and they write up a big report, and they talk to as many people as they could who were involved. This is an example of, you know, us trying to do investigation in a way that's not statistical, that's not randomized, that I think is the way you have to do this sort of thing. And I think some of them are pretty cool. The only one that we've put out publicly so far, because these things take a long time, is on the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's impact on healthcare for the homeless program. And just want to remind people, I mean, we're looking for cases with these history studies of groups having a big impact on policy for a little money. We're pretty agnostic as to whether we agree with the change in policy, because that's not the question we're asking. So, I mean, that I think, if it's on our blog, and if you Google, like, healthcare for the homeless case study, GiveWell, you know, that should be a way to find it. And I think I was like, fairly convinced that there was something there. That was largely a case in which, by providing a demonstration model of how healthcare for the homeless could be set up, they were in position to then get that added to a bill when homelessness was a big issue. And otherwise, it would have been like, they're just, you know, people would have been, well, we could add healthcare to this bill. We don't really know how to do it. We don't have any examples of it working, so we won't do it. And that, I think, is a common approach in policy, is to try and, you know, create a proof of concept, get some ideas ready to go. You never know when your political moment will come. And when it comes, it's going to be too late to start work on them then. Other examples that will be out soon or are out. I mean, we have two more case studies coming out. One that I really like, although it could take a little while for it to become public, is on the Affordable Care Act and the role philanthropy played in that. And we had, you know, basically the person working on this, Ben Soskis, basically tried to chase down all the different ways in which philanthropy affected it. Some of it was in the end game, where it was like a big campaign being funded largely by Atlantic Philanthropies. Some of it was way earlier, just building up little state groups that created, you know, had a part in creating Romney Care, without which I think Affordable Care couldn't have happened. So, you know, that I think is a really good one. Final thing that you can Google on our site, Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. We had a conversation with them. We posted notes from it. And I think we have not done the historical inquiry, but I am going to guess that those are going to check out and be really impressive. This is a group that basically looks for opportunities to do trustworthy analysis that that changes people's minds about what a policy should be, usually in the direction of favoring lower income Americans. And I think they've had some examples of success where, just like, based on the story, it's just like, yeah, unless this person's just lying, that sounds like that was probably a really good one. So those are the examples. Other question, other countries. We do work in the US for now, largely for practical reasons. You have to build a network. You have to meet people who are good at this. You have to have a lot of background knowledge. I think that's just infeasible for us to start trying to change policy in France right now or something. In the future, yeah, we've thought about it. We've had conversations. Maybe, you know, maybe the real place that matters is China. In a lot of ways, China's policy matters more than the U.S. I don't think there's no country that I would bet right now is going to turn out, after all the analysis is in, to be more important to work in than the U.S. or better to work in than the U.S. So I think, if, you know, that's a different claim. Like, if we looked at all of them, I think some country would be a better place to work. But I've thought about the obvious candidates, and I think, the U.S. is really important and really huge, and just a world power, and what it does matters a lot. B, the U.S. has this political system that in many ways is more fertile ground for this kind of work than a lot of other systems. It's like a lot more fragmented, and there's just a lot more like opportunities for interest groups to make a difference. And I think that's a real thing. Often leads to bad results, but if we're trying to exploit that, it can lead to good results. I don't think that's conclusive, but I there's no country I would say right now, like, yeah, this one's definitely better to work in. Yeah, Bill.
This is more of an observation than a question, although maybe there's a last question embedded in it. But, you know, picking up on Bob Cutler's observation that particularly the macro stability issue tends to get polarized by ideology.
Yeah.
Even though there are very, very technical issues involved. And, you know, when I had a chance to talk with you earlier this year and get a little more detail about the advocacy group that was, I think one of the things they went through was Jackson Hole, where Janet Yellen is speaking, and they had signs saying, "Want to know about labor dynamics? Ask, you know, ask an unemployed worker." I mean, from my perspective, because I know a little bit about this field, I couldn't imagine something with anything closer to zero marginal effectiveness moving the needle
sure.
in that debate. Janet Yellen, the labor economist, is extremely sensitive to those issues. And so I know I'm aware of the arguments of Paul Krugman saying if you could only have 4% inflation for a few years, you could burn off the debt and all that. But it just struck me that once you get to those arguments, it's a very political issue. And therefore, you know, I guess my
so just to clarify,
when I heard about that advocacy, that sounded like almost a political action committee that I was affiliating with, as opposed to, you know, the original GiveWell brand, which was,
right,
you know, more the Peter Singer Save a Life type of thing, which, you know, conservatives and liberals could
sure.
agree on is important kind of independent of ideology. But in this particular issue, or when I looked at Alexander's work, I would say 80% of his sources were left-leaning economists.
On this cause, not on, I would not say that would be true across all causes.
No, I think the whole macro.
Sure, on this cause, yeah.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So in other words, though, my concern, maybe the question is moving to some of these issues actually kind of repositioning you as closer to a political action committee, which is perfectly fine if you're pivoting to, you know, the 0.01, you know, the billionaires who are perfectly free to, you know, support whatever causes they like, as opposed to sort of just a GiveWell brand. How do you guys think about that kind of conflict in the two brands that are developing here?
Sure. So how do we think about the brand conflict, and is there a risk of turning into a political action committee? From a regulatory standpoint, I mean, I'm highly confident that everything we've done is totally, you know, totally kosher, and we've, you know, checked, I mean, we're checking all that out with legal counsel, and there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of distance between, there's a lot of space in between distributing bed nets and being a PAC. We're not a PAC. We don't support PACs. So I think there's a lot you can do to influence policy, and there's a long history of philanthropy doing it that is not, you know, not a PAC and is totally fine from a regulatory standpoint. From a brand standpoint, I mean, yeah, we're definitely changing. I mean, but we're trying to split, not pivot. And that's why there's the new name. And that is why we are intending to split into two organizations down the line. We know that these are not the same project. These are just two completely different projects. That's what we want them to be. The continuity between them is that what we've always been interested in is how do you do the most good possible? I think if we were to say, how do you do the most good possible, as long as it's nothing that people disagree with, and as long as the right and the left can come together equally on it, and as long as it doesn't involve doing things that are controversial and that are political and things that, you know, get in the news in kind of a simplified, distorted way, I don't think we'd be doing the most good possible anymore. I think we're closing off too many things at that point. And I especially think that the, you know, I think it's definitely the case that the most experienced philanthropists would be more adamant than I am that we aren't doing the most good that way. So I think I'm actually less convinced than they are, but there's certainly a strong perspective out there that says that these are ridiculous things to close off. You at least have to look into them. That's what's always driven us as people. That's what we've always been interested in. I, you know, all else equal, I'd rather work on something that everyone agreed on. I'd rather work on something that wasn't controversial, but all else isn't equal. And I think we have to check out all these opportunities to do good. That's what we want to do as people. As far as an organization goes, pragmatically, we're housing Open Philanthropy Project at GiveWell for now, and eventually we expect those brands to split. One more comment just on the effectiveness of advocacy for the Fed. I'm not going to get into exactly why I think what I think. I'm just going to state that we did, you know, ask this question very, like, very thoughtfully and put a lot of work into it and talk to as many people as we could reach who understand how these decisions are made. Alexander did a great deal of research on how the Fed makes its decisions, how the whole structure works, who exactly is being targeted by this group, and why we think they might be influenced. And just to be clear, I don't think the chances of influencing anyone are great, but I definitely don't think it can be ruled out. And I think that what we did is you know, well considered with respect to that. It's certainly an issue that we were, you know, that I was equally nervous about, and I feel that we're now on top of. So I'm going to go. We only have 15 minutes left, and I have two more giant topics to cover. So, but they will be shorter than that one, I think. So I'm going to talk about global catastrophic risks. I mentioned before these are things that you could imagine sort of derailing or changing the trajectory of civilization. I know that sounds hyperbolic, but I think with the things I'm going to talk about, it's you know, oftentimes not. So I guess I'll probably start with climate change just because it's a good intro to this space. Climate change is definitely something that could affect the entire planet, could have really magnified impacts. On the other hand, climate change is something that does get a lot of attention from funders, from nonprofits, from advocacy groups. I think there are other causes that are as dangerous or as important that are getting less attention, in general. But I think there's one aspect of climate change that I think is pretty interesting. Most of the groups out there today are pretty focused on reducing carbon emissions, and that reduces the risks of something really bad happening. But regardless of how much we reduce carbon, I mean, not regardless, but if we don't reduce carbon emissions a huge amount and what looks like a realistic amount at this point, what we have is we have a bunch of economic models that tell us that climate change is going to cause a lot of damage, but basically leave society, you know, society is going to be a lot better off 100 years from now than it is now, even net of climate change. And that is what the projections say. That's what the standard projections are saying. I think the thing that worries me most is that those projections might be wrong. I don't think anyone has a lot of faith in those projections. And I think climate change could be a lot worse than anyone's saying it will be. And the question is, if it happens, and it's, sorry, if it turns out, if it happens that it is much worse than anyone is currently projecting, there are kind of very high risk things we could do other than reducing emissions that are a lot cheaper, a lot more reliable, and a lot more effective, and also a lot more dangerous to deal with that situation. So the classic example here is solar radiation management, which could include something like shooting sulfur into the atmosphere to cool the planet. This is completely crazy in the sense that it's, you know, it's like, it's basically messing with the entire global ecosystem, and we don't know what the effects will be. It may be something that turns out to be something people want to do if climate change turns out to be really, really bad. Another issue with solar radiation management is that anyone can do it, which is actually a really scary thought. Any country can decide that it would like the entire planet to be cooler. And so if any country decides that and there's not a good framework in place and there isn't good research in place on how to do it as safely as possible, that itself could be a global catastrophic risk. And so the general area of doing research on geoengineering and saying, what do we know about how this would affect the planet? How much could we know? What is the safest way to do this? What is the best way to do this? And maybe most importantly, how are we going to decide who's allowed to do this? What's the global governance around this? That's a pretty empty space. And it's been pretty surprising to me that you see, you know, the hundreds of millions of dollars going into trying to reduce carbon emissions, but it's like a very sparse area of people trying to research geoengineering and figure out how we're going to govern it. And to me, in some ways, this is the most important part of the whole space, because this is the part of the climate change issue that could be most catastrophic, is either needing this technology or using it and having bad results from it. So something we're looking into, and Howie Lempel works on global catastrophic risks. He's currently kind of getting to know the Solar Radiation Management Governance Initiative, another one of those names. And they're basically trying to solve that problem of getting people together to talk about who's going to be allowed to do this, how we're going to govern it. I think that's research that ought to be done, and we're thinking about whether to support that group. Other global catastrophic risks, there's the general issue of biosecurity, which I think is a lot more salient today than it was when we started working on it because of Ebola. I think Ebola, in the scheme of things, is not the scariest pandemic we could have. I think, you know, arguably the flu, if it was the wrong kind of flu, could kill an enormous number of people and be incredibly disruptive. Even worse than the flu could be a hypothetical future disease that comes out of a lab, whether on purpose or by accident, and that has, you know, properties no natural disease has. How can we be prepared for this? There's a lot of different ways to talk about how to be prepared for this. One idea is to talk about how strong global surveillance systems are. How good are we at catching a pandemic early and responding to it and containing it rather than having to respond after it gets out of control? Obviously, there's at least some parts of the world where we don't have as good capacity to do that as we could. Strengthening global surveillance could be a way to prevent both the potential flus and the potential synthetic pandemics. You know, there's a whole bunch of other aspects to biosecurity. It's actually a huge space in the sense that there's a lot of government in it and a lot of government money, but it gets almost no attention from philanthropy. And so a question we've asked is, what does that mean? Do we consider this space crowded or not crowded when there's a ton of government and very little philanthropy? So far, our answer is we should probably think of it more as not crowded because there's the government has certain strengths and weaknesses, and so does philanthropy. And we think there's going to be opportunities to do things government can't or won't do or improve the way government is dealing with these things to be more prepared for a pandemic, whether natural or synthetic. That's when we may end up going the kind of like full-time specialist expert in that cause route, because that is a very big cause of a lot of stuff going on. By contrast, geoengineering is a smaller field, though we may go that way with geoengineering too. Some other causes, there's geomagnetic storms. So basically solar flares, a really bad one could potentially damage a lot of transformers and cause like a really bad blackout that could, according to some people's claims, be long-lasting and global and could be incredibly disruptive. Maybe not as scary as the other two things, but easier to prepare for. And we've basically been contracting with our favorite evidence reviewer, David Rudman, who's put out a few reports on our site about like who we should listen to about how scary geomagnetic storms are. And the kind of tentative conclusion is, we not only need more information, we know how to get it. And so there may be good opportunities here to basically learn more about how robust our current system would be to a really bad solar flare. So that's, you know, that's one we're working on. Other global catastrophic risks, I mean, nukes is one that gets more attention than most of the ones I just mentioned, but there may be more to do there. It's definitely an immediate and drastic risk, just the idea of like a nuclear war. There's some cross-cutting stuff, like a lot of these risks, including climate change, including nukes, including some other things, the scariest aspect of them would be their impact on the food supply. So are there, you know, ways we could be more resilient to a disruption in the food supply? There's, you know, questions around when and how and what's going to happen when artificial intelligence gets much more powerful. This is something that I think has been in the news somewhat recently, and I think is getting taken a lot more seriously now than it was like a year ago. I think it's something that's like a long way off and it's really unclear what we could do. But basically our only action on that point right now is Howie is going to go to a conference on this pretty soon and try to, like, we think it's a good conference to try and figure out how serious this issue is and whether there's anything that could be meaningfully done today. I mean, I think it's fairly clear that if and when we develop really powerful artificial intelligence, that will be a situation that has high potential for big positives and big negatives. The question is whether there's anything to do today that would make it more likely to go positive. We really don't know the answer to that. So that's global catastrophic risks. And I'll take questions for like 10 more minutes. Yeah.
Asteroids
is one we looked into and is not on our priority list. So an asteroid could hit the Earth and a big enough one could, you know, cause a huge amount of death and destruction. So asteroids are pretty well quantified and well understood, and the risks are known to be like pretty low. The expected lives lost in terms of like on a yearly basis is just not very high. And I think the asteroids that are big enough to cause like a real global problem, we believe that the money is basically there to track them, and most of them have been tracked. So I don't think that cause looks as good as the other ones. And you know, one of the general patterns here is all the things I just named are more kind of like human-made problems that are much more scary as of 200 years ago than they would have been before that. Anything that's been like a candidate to wipe out the species for millions of years and hasn't done it is kind of inherently less scary. Yep.
Do you think that
estimates on the probabilities for these global catastrophes can ever be accurate? Because I see numbers for some of these things that people
yeah.
come up with, like, you know, 1% chance, 2% chance over some time frame. It seems like everybody doing research in this space are people who are obsessed with these issues and probably overestimating by orders of magnitude. Is it possible to come up with reliable estimates of, like, the odds of, you know,
yeah.
AI or bioterrorism that wipes out, you know, millions of people?
Yeah, is it possible to estimate the odds of some of these global catastrophic risks? And I would say no, it's not possible with the information we have. I mean, some of them, yes. Asteroids, yes. But yeah, for the most part, it's not. And I think we just have to live with that. We have thought about what we could do to sort of get the best estimates available. You know, there are sort of processes that are believed to lead to better results than just guessing. And if you pulled together a lot of the most knowledgeable people and had them go through that process, you may get a better estimate. But it's not really at the top of our list. I think basically with all these, this is such a hard area to compare to others because we're talking about, you know, the odds that we actually make a difference are really, really tiny. And the potential size of the difference we made is really, really huge. And we don't know what any of those numbers are. And that's why we've kind of thrown global catastrophic risks into their own bucket. We think it's an interesting area. We think there's a lot to be learned. We think it's a good fit for philanthropy, and a lot of them are neglected by philanthropy. So we want to work on them. But yeah, we don't really have a great way of comparing them to other causes. And so it's been kind of something where we said, look, this one makes sense. We'd like to work on it and see how good we feel about it in 5 years. Same with U.S. policy, same with science. And we haven't really had a lot of framework for comparing them to each other yet. Yep.
What do you think about, like, space research in particular, like colonization? As a solution to global catastrophe.
Yeah, what do I think about space colonization as a solution to global catastrophic risks? I think it's, like, in the long run, maybe the best solution. I think it's a long way away, and also I think is... I think there's more funding and support for exploring that kind of thing than for dealing with a lot of the risks I'm talking about. And it's kind of knowably a long way away. I mean, a lot of these other things, they're actually pretty unpredictable. Some of them we know are not going to happen tomorrow. There's almost nothing here that I could really promise you, you know, can't become a risk within the next few decades. And I think space colonization looks pretty unlikely to get there within the next few decades unless it's, like, assisted by some of these other developments like artificial intelligence. I'm basically out of time to talk about science. I'll just mention that we are also thinking about science. And we have a small team of junior scientific advisors because I think it's, you know, science is basically, it's like another language. And so you have to have someone to translate, even to get at the most basic questions. So you kind of need experts even before you start. I think we do have a lot of interesting stuff we found on science. We're well aware there's a ton of money that goes into it already. The NIH is, you know, tens of billions of dollars a year supporting biomedical research. And so you have to be, the numbers in science to be like a big funder in science are very big compared to what they are in policy. Like you can be a major player in policy for much less money. And we know that. And so that creates a challenge. And so our question for science has been like, what are the big funders failing to do and why are they failing to do it in a way that we might be able to fill in the gaps? And the answer to that could be nothing, but preliminarily, I believe there's quite a bit, and we will be writing about it. So that's one of the things I have on my to-do list. Hopefully, I'll get to it in the next month, just a whole series of posts on what we've done on science, because it's been a year since we've written about it. It wasn't a focus of ours this year. It was just something I did when I, like, could, and I was working with the junior advisors. But, you know, we do have some interesting preliminary theories, and when we get time, we'll explore them more in depth. So I'll take like 5 more minutes of questions or maybe 10, but people can leave because it's 9:30. And then, you know, then we'll call it. Yep.
So this is going back to policy. What do you think about like meta policy initiatives like the Lawrence Lessig's May Day PAC? Do you think there's value in that?
Sure. What do I think of meta policy initiatives like Lawrence Lessig's May Day PAC? So one of the causes on our list of policy causes is like, it's called improving democracy. Which basically means that. And we've been looking for an angle that we're excited about. We just haven't found one yet. So one angle is like the money in politics thing. It's saying, you know, we need more regulation to get people to, you know, to get money to play less of a role in politics. I mean, according to our understanding of policy and according to the people we trust most understanding of policy, which again, you know, there's no formula here except to learn as much as we can to make the best contacts we can that seem to be experts and learn from them. You know, that one, A, I think it has a fair amount of interest, but B, I think it's, there have been campaign finance reforms in the past, and I think they've arguably made things worse instead of making them better. And I think it's really hard to design something that I really believe would have a big impact on the problems we see. Like, I think generally the people that we take most seriously on these issues just don't see that as the main lever by which democracy could get better. There's another school of thought, which you could read about on the Hewlett Foundation's blog. They're trying to become, I guess, you know, one of the most transparent foundations out there. And so their blog has definitely got more on it than most foundations. So they write a lot about this. They're trying to think more about polarization. So, like, instead of talking about the role of money, they're talking about the role of, like, how the parties have grown apart over the years and what we can do to restore kind of centrism and reason to the debate. Also, we don't feel great about that one, but also that's partly because there's a lot of interest in that one from philanthropy and from foundations, and also, like, for various reasons, we also kind of don't see that as a great lever either. But you could read about that. I mean, that's one of the few cases where a foundation has written a lot about what they're doing and why they're doing it and how they're thinking about it. Google Madison Initiative, Hewlett, there's a lot of stuff to read. Yep.
You're just talking about science. I was wondering if you put much thought into policy advocacy based on science. Obviously, the government's a huge fan of science.
Yeah.
Maybe the best way to influence that would be to say, to get them to work on things that they're neglecting, what would be really important.
Yeah. Have we thought about policy advocacy on science? Yeah, we have. And that is actually probably it's definitely one of the areas we're most excited about from a science perspective. And the reason is that I think the science funders I'm aware of, it's like I can name a bunch that I think are, like, everyone would say they're really, really good on the science. They really know what good science is, and they know what the government could be doing better. And they're kind of like, they have the right people and the right knowledge to do a great job. Those groups tend to be totally uninterested in systemic change and advocacy. And there's a lot of complaints right now, and the complaints tend to echo each other. This is actually doesn't feel very polarized to me about what the NIH is doing wrong, and what the tenure system is doing wrong, what the publication system is doing wrong. And I think most of the science funders that we perceive as best, their solution is to lead by example, where most other foundations in other fields would say, you know, screw example, let's fund some people to make noise about this issue, to come up with specific proposals so we're ready when the political moment comes, et cetera. And then meanwhile, there's, like, maybe one science funder I can think of that's kind of the opposite, where I feel like they have paid more attention to policy and advocacy than they have to the actual science. And I think they've, like, been surprisingly impactful, but maybe not in a good direction. And so that's, you know, that's an area where we feel like if you could put together the capacity to have really deep knowledge of the science and have, like, the best scientists on your team with the capacity to understand how to change policy, that would be pretty exciting. However, those are both capacities we currently lack, and so it could be a while before we really get there. Yep.
How much do you expect to focus on the kind of meta issues, like meta research,
Yeah, how much do we plan to focus on meta issues in science, like publication bias and things like that? So I've been focused on biomedical research just because it's, like, the biggest area, and I just wanted to start with something where I felt it would prepare me for other things. And in that area, I think the biggest meta issues have more to do with the tenure system, the publication system, and the NIH system. And I think publication bias... Well, actually, specifically within in medicine, publication bias can be an issue. But in the areas I've looked at most, which are more like basic biology, I think that stuff is actually less of the key issue. The answer is, like, for any given area, we try to figure out what the most important sub-issues are and focus in on those. But that's my quick answer to you on that. Yeah, something that is very different about the Open Philanthropy Project obviously, is that it requires a lot more, like, we can't have everything we say be based on a rigorous study or on, you know, some incontrovertible set of facts, and we do make a lot of judgment calls. The thing that we're trying to keep continuous with GiveWell is just our willingness to talk about it, our interest in talking about it, and our basic promise that whenever you ask why we believe something, we try to tell you. A lot of times there's more layers in Open Philanthropy Project because you need to have people who you believe are experts and a reason for believing they're experts, and a lot of your knowledge comes from them. But that's the point of continuity we're trying to keep. And, you know, basically where we are with Open Philanthropy is I think we have a long way to go. I think all we have right now is ideas we're interested in, and we aren't moving a lot of money out the door, and I think there's good reasons for that. But what I think we're on a path toward doing is basically understanding what issues are most interesting to us, what issues we most want to become experts in, then building the capacity to do that, and down the line, having, you know, really great and defensible and well-reasoned giving ideas that we're then pitching to major philanthropists. And I think, you know, we hope to have a major impact with how GoodVenture spends its money, and also with when the whole next generation of philanthropists gets as interested in it as GoodVentures is, we hope to have a major impact on them as well. So, yeah, it's 9:36, so I'm going to call it now, but I'm happy to stay around and talk after.